Welcome, everyone. Good evening. And thank you for joining us on such a fortuitous occasion as the Ides of March. My name is Paige Wiley, and I have the pleasure of introducing our speakers. But before I do so, I would like to thank the American Enterprise Institute, which sponsors our little group here at Swarthmore and enables us to bring speakers and host events to broaden policy discussions on our campus. I would also like to thank my fellow members of the AEI Executive Committee here on campus who helped make this possible. Gloria Kim and Ben Termott and Nate Urban, who can't be here, have all put in a great deal of work. Joining me on stage are Dr. Kevin Hassett and Professor Mark Cooperberg. Kevin Hassett is a Swarthmore alumnus of the class of 1984. He is the State Farm James Q. Wilson Chair in American Politics and Culture at the American Enterprise Institute, where he specializes in tax, energy, and budgetary issues, fiscal policy, and the stock market. Before working with AEI, he was a senior economist at the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System and an associate professor of economics and finance at the Graduate School of Business of Columbia University. He was also the chief economic advisor to the presidential campaigns of former President George W. Bush, Senator John McCain, and Governor Mitt Romney. After graduating from Swarthmore with honors in economics, he earned his PhD at the University of Pennsylvania. He frequently writes for many publications such as the National Review, Los Angeles Times, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and the Washington Post. Professor of Economics Mark Cooperberg, who joined Swarthmore's faculty in 1977, teaches popular courses on macroeconomics. His areas of interest include macroeconomics, public finance, and the law in economics. After receiving his BA from Amherst, he earned his PhD in economics at MIT. His TEDx Swarthmore talk is titled The Case for Big Government, The Case Americans Don't Want to Hear. He has held visiting professorships at Haverford College, the University of California at Berkeley, Johns Hopkins University, the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton University, and the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. He professes to be playing David to Kevin's Goliath here today. Before we get started, we have to lay down the rules. Too many imponderables could invite anarchy. As such, I have rules for both the speakers and the audience, so nobody feels left out. On that note, we also have a participation ribbon for whoever ends up losing this debate. Just kidding. At Swarthmore, everyone wins. So the rules are these. First, the format will consist of two sections, one of about 55 minutes and one of about 25. The first will ask the question, is economic inequality a problem? The second will ask, what, if anything, should be done about it? We will begin with each presenting their case for 15 minutes, first Mark and then Kevin, then proceed with their cross-examinations of one another. Then they may take several questions from the audience. They then will move on to the second section in which they present their solutions, take questions from the audience, and make brief concluding arguments. Finally, in case it becomes relevant, I ask that we use profanity sparingly. I don't want to be accused of moderating a debate of excessive tawdriness. Some tawdriness is okay. The rules for the audience are these. First, if you must make an early departure, please use the doors in the back of the room only and exit quietly. Also, if you have friends joining us later, let them know that it's quite full and they may need to come sit up at the front. And lastly, for the question and answer, we've passed out some note cards. We ran out. But if you have something to write upon, you may write down your questions, and we'll collect the note cards if you pass them towards this aisle, and a couple members of the council will come collect them before the question and answer sessions begin. So, and then upon collecting those, our council will select a few to read and to have the speakers address. With that being said, we're so grateful to you all for joining us tonight. I hope this is the Ides of March matchup of your dreams. And let us begin with Professor Cooperberg's arguments.
Okay, so first I'd like to thank Kevin for coming. He's always been a really good friend of the department, unsparing of his time, coming to many events, giving talks. And I was walking home one day, and a student came up to me and said, oh, you're debating this guy. Who is he? I said, well, he's pretty famous. He said, more famous than you? And I said, yeah, outside of a square mile parish hall, definitely. So so it's a pleasure to have Kevin here. I hope this will be more like a moderated two-person panel discussion than a debate, but we'll see. Okay. So here we go. Okay, so I'm going to talk about the types of inequality there are and what's happened to them over time in the United States mostly. So the first type of inequality is inequality of income. So economists divide income into two parts, labor income, where inequality has risen a lot, as we'll see, and inequality of wealth and capital income, where inequality is immense. And then there's inequality of opportunity. And then there's inequality of consumption, which I think Kevin is going to talk more about, and then I may rebuttal that. Okay, so first we'll start with total income. So it turns out 1980 is a very big year in this story. Do you have a color? Oh, it doesn't show up for you. Okay, anyway. So 1980 is a pretty big story, pretty big year. And until then, in the United States, incomes were growing pretty much evenly across income classes. But starting in 1980, they diverged, and you can see that in this picture. And so this is, again, another picture of from the end of World War II to 1979. This divides the income distribution into fifths. Quintiles. Kevin will talk about quintiles also. It's the common way to do it. And you can see that all, even the lowest fifth, they're all growing pretty much at the same percent per year. That was until 1980. After 1980, it's completely different. The lowest quintile is losing money. The next lowest is gaining a tad, and the top fifth is gaining twice as much as the fourth fifth. And so if you look at it, I'm not fixated about the 1%. I know there are people who are. It is quite amazing, and here you can see how amazing it is. This is real after-tax income, once again starting in 1979, and the top 1%, their income increased 200. These things really do not work. 278%, but, you know, there's still only 1%. So income inequality is increasing across the board in the United States, and the 1% are simply the most extreme version of that. Okay, so this is a final picture on income. There's the 1% again. There's everybody else. This is real inflation-adjusted after-tax income, so it's the best measure of income. And you can see that starting in 1980, I mean, it's grown, but hasn't grown very much for most people, whereas it's grown. So over an entire 30-year period, the bottom quintile got 40% increase. Top 1% got a 200% increase. Okay, labor income. So this is a chart, labor income. And labor income was most equal. This is, if we look at this thing, which is the 90-10 differential, meaning how much bigger are the incomes of people at the 90th percentile of the wage distribution versus the 10th percentile. And you can see that it was most equal in really right around 1973, and it's becoming more and more unequal since then. You can see that in terms of this thing called the Gini coefficient. So there'll be a lot of slides that have the Gini coefficient. Let me just explain what that is. So it's a measure of inequality. It goes from 0 to 1. 0 is complete equality. 1 is complete inequality. That would be like if we were all Kevin Hassett's slaves. So the Gini coefficient, which is here on the right side, 0.55 is really quite high. It's more than halfway to complete inequality. It's going to be tricky. Okay, and so this is the 90-50 differential. Once again, 90% of the labor, top 10% of labor income versus 50%, and that's also, it's gonna be tough. Okay, that's also increased tremendously. The 50-10 differential, the difference between the middle of the wage distribution and the people at the very bottom, the 10%, that really hasn't changed much since 1990. It's been pretty flat, but there was inequalities starting in 1980. Okay. So inequality of wealth. Okay, so this wealth is much less evenly distributed than income. And you can see that here. So the distribution of income, if we just look at the top 3%, the top 3% of earners have 31% of all the income, but they have 54% of all the wealth. And it turns out, this I only learned while I was preparing these slides, that after tax rates of return are actually pretty even across the income distribution. It's not the case, pre-tax returns are not, but after-tax returns, it's not the case that high earners are earning higher returns on their wealth than low earners, which is kind of, they don't have a lot of wealth, the low earners. As we can see, the bottom 90% only has 25% of the entire wealth in the society. But what that means is that this pie chart here, while it's the percentage of wealth, is also the percentage of income. So what that says is that the top 3% are getting 54% of all the capital income. The bottom 90% are getting 90%. So if you had 100 people lined up, 90 people would be getting 25% of the capital income, and 3 people would be getting 54% of the capital income in the country. Okay, and so this is the top 3% again, the bottom 90%, and the sort of the middle group. Well, they're not the middle group. They're between the 4% and the 10% to the top. They've stayed pretty flat. The bottom 97 have fallen. The top 3% have increased in terms of their wealth. And this is kind of an amazing chart. So it turns out that it's only the top 0.1%. So it's not a lot of people. But it's kind of amazing that the total wealth of the top 0.1% is now equal, that's the green line, is now equal to the entire wealth of the bottom 90%. So these lines are almost touching, and that is, I would say, pretty incredible. So if, once again, if we lined up 100 people, you'd have to slice one of those people into tenths, and that person would have 25% of the wealth in the country, and then 90 other people would have the same amount of wealth as the one-tenth slice of that person. Okay, so capital versus labor income. So it used to be, in the old days, we used to teach this all the time. In fact, microeconomics, NEC 1, is probably pretty much still teaching it, that productivity and total compensation move hand in hand. And that was true in 1947 to 1973. It was mostly true in 1973, 1979. It stopped being true 1979 to 90. What turned out, workers are producing all this, but they're only getting to take home the black. Workers are producing all this, they're only getting to take home the black. Workers are producing this whole blue thing, they're only getting to take home the black. And so the outcome of all that is here. If you look at the share that labor has of all GDP produced by the non-farm business sector, used to be that was a flat number because it corresponded to the fact that total compensation was moving hand in hand with productivity. So it, you know, bounces around a bunch, but it was up till about, even really you could say up to 2000, it was more or less flat. Since then it's fallen through the floor. That if we say here that if we make 100 to be index everything to 100 for 2009, workers are now getting 97.5% of that. They used to get way up here 110% of that. So what that means is that of all the GDP that's being produced, it's not just that labor income is unequal. We saw that. It's not that capital income is unequal. We saw that. It's way more unequal because the holdings of wealth are way, way more unequal. It's not just that. It's that the share that capital is getting is increasing too. Okay. And so inequality of economic opportunity. So there is a view, which we could talk about later, that, oh, inequality is okay as long as there's mobility. I actually take issue with that view from a philosophical perspective, but maybe we'll talk about that later. But let's say you even believe that inequality is totally permissible as long as there's mobility. Well, not so much. So here's the United States versus these other countries, like Denmark, my God, who would ever want to live there? And so the United States has less mobility. This has more mobility than the United Kingdom. Okay, you know, Downton Abbey is still going. But has less mobility than all of these other countries, which I don't think most people realize. So then there's this thing that called the Great Gatsby Curve. I think that's a terrible name because the book wasn't very good. But this is sort of American exceptionalism. So the United States is both the most unequal in this picture and also has the least mobility. So that's a sort of a regression line, I guess. And you can see that it's not what people think. It's not the case that more inequality means more mobility. That would be an upward sloping line. What it means, more inequality means less mobility. Okay. And that's true across countries. It's also true within the United States. So these little dots are little bins of commuting areas, U.S. commuting zones. And so you were looking at how much mobility is in different commuting zones within the United States. And what you can see, it's the same negative relationship, that the more inequality a commuting zone has, the less mobility, except for this guy who knows what he's up to. And so that holds across countries, and it holds within the United States. So, and that's, I'm done. So let me try to figure out how to get you.
Are you putting this up?
Yeah. This is non-trivial.
A very sophisticated method.
Okay, I will call you back in a few minutes. Okay, so if you want God, to have a...
Can people move away from the door, please? They're moving.
Okay, I'll pause for a sec while folks... There are a lot of seats over here. Just trying to be respectful of the fire marshal. So thanks. It's really great to be back here at Swarthmore. When I think about what Swarthmore is, what makes it different, I think the first thing that comes to mind is community, that Swarthmore builds a community that stays with you your whole life. I knew Mark before he got tenure. Yeah. I argued strenuously against it. But not really. It may seem hard to believe, but before he got tenure, he was a really fun guy. But it's not just Mark I forget whether I even ever told you this, but I took Mark's macro class. We used Gordon's textbook. It was red then. I don't know if you're still using Gordon's textbook. And then I went to Penn to grad school. Like many of the gray hairs in the room, I married a Swarthmore girl. She went to Penn Law. Because she was a year ahead of me, and then I went to Penn grad school because she was at Penn Law. My first year in grad school, the macro teacher that I had was Steve O'Connell, who was at Penn. I couldn't see. Steve was going to try to come. He has guests from out of town in today. But I saw Steve earlier today. But at Penn, in the grad program, it's one of these old-fashioned PhD programs, they still do this a little, where they fail about half the people at the end of the first year. So it's a very high-stress period. They view that competition as creating better economists. But after the first year, they take the best person in each class and they TA the class the following year. And in my second year at Penn, I was the TA in the macro class. And the reason I was the TA in the macro class is that I was the best student in the macro class because he prepared me so well. Nobody had the prep. There are a lot of smarter people than me in grad school, but nobody was better prepared in macroeconomics. So my bonds to this community are very deep. When I was here, everybody was talking about Bernie, but it was a different Bernie Safran. And I remember coming back for his memorial service and speaking there. Bernie Safran taught a econ theory class to the economics majors, and everybody had to take it, the seminar, that by far is the most important class I ever took in economics in my life. And then I go to Columbia after I graduate from Penn, and who's a junior faculty member with me there but Phil Jefferson? We even attended the same church, Phil. Do you remember that? Riverside Church. When Steve... decided to leave Penn, I can remember either talking to you or to Bernie and recommending him heavily for Swarthmore, and I think his long, successful run here proves that that's a good idea. But the thing about Swarthmore, so we stay close. We cherish the friends that we disagree with the most because we learn the most from them. I disagree over time, I guess, or maybe I don't disagree so much with Mark as he disagrees with me. And so if I write something, actually, I was sort of surprised because I wrote a piece in the Wall Street Journal last Saturday about the Fed and everything that's wrong with the Fed, and I didn't get this flaming, angry answer from Mark. And so I fantasize that he agrees with me when I don't get an email. But over the years, I've written a lot about inequality, going back to the 90s, a lot of scholarly work, thinking carefully about how to measure it, and both in whether we should use income or consumption, and if we are going to use income, how to do it. I have a paper in the American Economic Review that talks about how to measure horizontal versus vertical inequality and so on. I've been thinking about it for a long time and got more involved in it recently when Thomas Piketty, his book came out, and I was asked to be a sort of disputant for that book at the American Economic Association meetings, and then the article that Alan Auerbach and I wrote about that appeared in the American Economic Review. And so I sort of dug deeply again recently into the topic. And so how do you know if you win a debate? Well, from my perspective, maybe it's because I'm getting old and have perspective on these things, is that I win a debate if I learn something. And I expect that maybe I'll learn something. I haven't taken your class in a long time, though, so maybe not. I'm not sure I have yet, because we're looking at stuff that's in the literature. So Mark didn't put up anything that is incorrect. But what I want to do now is use my 15 minutes, which perhaps begins now, to not to say why Mark is wrong. There are certainly some things that I could dispute as along the way, but to talk about how I think about what the right question is and how to think about inequality, and then we'll start discussing where we disagree. I think that the backdrop for me is that, and this is a good friend of mine, Deirdre McCluskey, has a recent presentation that makes a point that Deirdre's been pushing throughout her career about just basically the miracle of capitalism, that basically, you know, human GDP per person stayed at what is today under World Bank standards, basically below the poverty level. And it did so for a really, really long time. And then all of a sudden, it took off. And there's this miraculous thing that all of a sudden welfare all around the world, so the dotted line at the bottom is world GDP per person, the triangle is Europe, and the square is the US. All of a sudden, people started to flourish, their GDP started to grow, we started to cure disease, and all these things that came about from the wealth that was created by capitalism. And then the question is, well, yeah, but capitalism, it creates differences. And differences for sure are concerning and maybe have political implications for the political scientists amongst us. So let's think about what happened over time as GDP per capita was going up, to the world income distribution and to the distribution of income within specific countries. This chart comes from my former colleague at Columbia, Xavier Salih Martin's work, where he uses parametric estimation to come up with a world distribution of income and then does it by country. And basically, I won't try to recapture the laser pointer magic that Mark just showed. But let's just say that the red line is 1970, and the sort of purpley, most purpley line farthest to the right is 2006. And the point is just that what's happened to the US income distribution is that it's moved towards me, and it's gotten wider. And so when you look at inequality, then you say, oh, geez, inequality's gone up. It sure has. If you look at, you know, just go to, you know, any point in the distribution and just look at how wide the red one is and then how wide the purple one is, and you'll see that inequality has for sure gone up, but also the median of the distribution has moved that way. This distribution is maybe log normal about, but there's some dispute about that. But the real interesting thing around the world, and I said that, well, it might be the Industrial Revolution that led to GDP growing a lot, but really I have certain feel that I'm on pretty strong ground that it was the spread of capitalism, but it's a lot of the work of Xavier that convinced me of this. But if you look around the world, there's something that's sort of more radical that's happened, and that is that as capitalism has spread, then places that used to be kind of centrally planned and didn't grow that much and had lots of poverty but lots of equality became fast-growing but with a lot more inequality. And so if you look at the Chinese, again, we can use the color coding, the red to the far left, the sort of light purple to the far right. You can see that the red one is way more equal, but the purple one is way to the right. I guess one problem I have when I think about inequality and what I hear people say, certainly not Mark, is that you know, I wonder about someone who wants to try to make the case that you should have the red one, that the red one is preferred to the purple one. Because if you think about the implication of the purple one, the dark line is the World Bank percentage of the population, is where the distribution hits the percentage of the population. If you go up, you can sort of see, if you're good at integrating in your head, the percentage of the population that is what the World Bank, below what the World Bank would say is the poverty line, goes from being, what do you think, integrating in your head, Mark? You're from MIT, you probably can do that. 45% about? In the red one, and sort of maybe about, 2% in the purple one. And so if you're thinking about, has the move towards capitalism, and there's a lot of problems with China, of course, but has the move towards capitalism been good for ordinary folks, for poor folks in China, then you would say, well, gosh, yeah, if you look at, you know, the measure of the people in poverty by the World Bank's dollar a day standard, it's had a radical effect. Xavier has done this for a lot of countries, every country that he can get data for. And I actually think, by the way, that I hope there might be a philosophy professor here. I was an honors examiner once, and I can remember the disputes in the grading thing, where I guess they're all off the record, so we're not allowed to talk about it, but it's years ago, so we can do it now. The debates between the philosophy professors and the religion professors over whether someone should be high honors or fail. And so I hope some of those people, if they're here, you could help me think about whether I think the world distribution of income is probably the thing we ought to think about. So a poor person here, if I'm a Rawlsian and I'm in my initial position and I'm thinking about who I care about and whose poverty concerns me, whether a person in the U.S. Deserves extra heavy weight compared to a person someplace else is something that, you know, maybe I would dispute, or I guess I would dispute. But if you look at the world distribution of income, it's really interesting how it's changed. And again, I guess just to mess this up, Xavier kind of moved the colors around a little bit. But if you go to the far left, you can see that, basically in 1970, half the world's population was below the poverty line. And now we're at the green thing in 2006, which is way to the right. It has moved a massive number of people out of poverty and has done so at the cost of increased inequality. The spread is higher in the green thing. So if we look at global inequality, Mark showed a coefficient about within country inequality. This is something that Thomas has done a lot too at his work. He emphasizes within country inequality. But if you look at global inequality, it's actually gone down a lot. And in anecdotal work, it's hard because there's not a lot of observations. But anecdotally, I think Xavier Salieri-Martin makes a pretty convincing case that it's the thing that has caused inequality to go down so much globally is the spread of capitalism. That you see places that are equal, they don't grow much, and then capitalism is adopted, and their central planning is relaxed, and then they get a chart that looks like the Chinese chart. And that's kind of recent world history. It's really kind of astonishing if you look at the sort of global poverty rate, how much has gone down as this has gone on. To talk about how I think about this, that I sort of am anxious with that as the backdrop story that we now have to interject discussion of American inequality about a sort of wholesale indictment of capitalism following from the fact that there's an income inequality and wealth inequality problem or it's getting wider in the U.S. Without sort of some acknowledgement that this system that we perhaps helped spread has had this radical positive effect on global poverty. So as we think about what we're going to do next, we should at least start out with a certain amount of humble respect for what we've accomplished. I think that latter is often not part of the conversation. So let's go to the U.S. I think at the American Economic Association debate, but I guess it was kind of like this. You were there, right, Mark?
No, the fire marshal wouldn't let me in.
Okay, it was pretty crowded. But at the debate, Tobau made a good point, which he said that, well, sure, global inequality is interesting, but the reason why you ought to care is that when income becomes more unequal, then political power becomes more unequal, and political power currently is determined by people in countries. And so we ought to study inequality in countries because that's where political power comes, because the danger is that the wealthy will get power, and then the wealthy with the power will use it to, you know, as Marx suggested, make you all my slaves. But when I started looking at the way Thomas made the case, I found some things that sort of gave me pause, and I just want to share them with you quickly. The first is that if you read the work that I did, go to nber.org and type in my name, and you'll see a really long piece about Piketty's book co-authored with Alan Auerbach at Berkeley. Or if you go to the AER, you'll see a shorter piece. But there is a lot of stuff in Piketty's book where he made data errors. And so I started to, they're very well documented. And so I started just deciding I had to get the data myself and make my own charts rather than rely on his when I was discussing him. But this main point that he makes, that income of the top 5% of households, which given the data that I could get quickly, is about as high up as I would want to go because there's not really good sampling at the top. And that's one of the problems that they've been, Piketty and Sias in particular, have been pioneers in trying to get a better perspective using tax data at the top. But still, you can see that the percentage of income received by the top 5% of households in the U.S., has gone from 1970, you know, what is it? That's about like 16, and it's gone way up above 20. And so nobody should dispute that income inequality has gotten, worse. Assumes that it's bad, but maybe since it did help destroy global poverty or really undermine it, maybe worse is not the right word. But let's just say that it's gotten bigger, the share of the top. And in Thomas' work, and I didn't hear Mark do this, but that at this point we sort of stop and we flagellate America. We say, oh, okay, so what a crappy society we have. The income of the top five is clearly skyrocketing, and maybe we need to be concerned that the rich are using politics to enrich themselves and enslave the others. But over the same time period, something that Thomas excludes from his charts, and I think that, Mark, your charts were pre-tax, pre-transfer, is that right? Because you didn't didn't say in your label, but I think it was. Okay, yeah, I have a problem with the way the CBO, but in any case, the U.S., no, the CBO's measure, and we could talk about this, but in any case, this is just simple census data, and this isn't in dispute. Everybody talks, I'm sure Mark teaches in his macro class, that entitlements are, you know, not funded, and, you know, maybe entitlement reform is necessary to restore budget balance in the long run, and the reason is that basically transfer payments as a percentage of GDP in the U.S. have gone over the same time period from about 6.5% to like about 13%. And the interesting thing is that the increase of transfers relative to GDP is almost the same in percent terms, I'm going back to the previous chart, as the increase of share of people at the top. And so both have gone up. So then you can say, well, what are you getting out of those transfers? And this is something that, to stipulate, because we didn't want to devolve into disputes about is the chart right, is the chart not right. I gave Mark my charts, my slides about a week ago, but I saw his slides tonight for the first time. it just reminds me of my seminar papers. Actually, it's not any tactic on his part. I always wrote them the night before. Did you notice? So the thing is that if we look at what we've accomplished with all those transfers, and this comes from work with, I've got a number of papers on this that I'm happy to give you guys to post if there's, or you could just look me up at AEI.org. And basically the top quintile and the bottom quintile, the red line is the top quintile, the blue line is the bottom quintile. And in terms of consumption inequality, which is what Hobbes said, consumption is the measure that we ought to consider. Hobbes argued for consumption instead of income because consumption is what you take out of society because once you eat it, it's gone, except for maybe fertilizer. Somebody got that. But if you look, the consumption inequality, the consumption of the two looks quite a bit different, and it makes complete sense. It's completely logical because we've increased transfers. Transfers go to people disproportionately at the bottom quintile, and their consumption has been bolstered by those transfers. If you look at Gini coefficients as we calculate them using the overall consumption of the Consumer Expenditure Survey, then consumption inequality, which again is a great measure of welfare, and it's what you take out of society, is basically not trending much at all. And so what I take, Mark talks about capital income. I'll skip the capital income thing for a second. I'll just say that what I take away from this is that if I wanted to give a thumbnail sketch now of what I think the American economy has done since 1970, it's this. It's grown a lot. It's produced a much wider distribution of income. It's produced an even wackier distribution of wealth, as Mark said. Wealth is really unequally distributed. At the same time, it's delivered growth in consumption for the bottom quintile that's about kept pace with people at the top by massively increasing the amount of transfers. Now, you could argue then that if we're going to step back and maybe go back to our Rawlsian initial position where we're talking about do we live in a just society, then you would say society did pretty well. Society did pretty well because as income became more unequal, resources were redistributed in a way that made consumption not so unequal. If you hate America, then maybe this chart might make you wonder about whether that's correct. But it also means that the dispute about inequality that we need to have is keeping up enough? Is consumption keeping up enough? And second, are these things sustainable? Because right now the transfers that have generated this consumption, this steady consumption share for the bottom quintile, are not funded in present value, and they might go away. And if we don't fund them, then they might disappear, in which case the starting from the initial condition of expanded income inequality could lead to a bad, very bad outcome. The capital income is a percentage of national income. This is a really important part of Piketty's argument. We could go into it in Q&A. But Piketty basically said that the reason why capitalism is going to destroy itself is that the capital income share is going up. As the capital income share goes up, then capitalists are going to invest in robots, and the robots are going to replace the workers, and then the workers won't have anything to eat. And he showed this chart, basically US, UK, and France. But the problem with that analysis, which is similar to the chart that Mark showed, is that if you take out, and this I did at first in a discussion of Piketty at the Urban Institute right after his book came out, if you break out capital income, if you take out housing from the definition of capital and just look at capital, so when you think of capital, when we teach capital in economics class, we think of capital as an input that a firm has. It's a machine. A house is a kind of different thing. There, housing capital isn't making stuff. It is making housing surfaces, but it's not necessarily giving people jobs either, except for building the houses. So the idea that the people who are putting their money in the bank and buying machines are going to replace everybody with robots because their income is skyrocketing is actually just not consistent in the data, that all of the trends that you see in these countries in the capital income share comes from housing. There's a big increase in housing, and the reason there's a big increase in housing is that lots of governments decided to subsidize housing. They're mass, like the mortgage interest deduction and so on. So that's the housing capital share of national income in the data. So housing capital is driving everything that Piketty sees in the data about capital. But the reason why that's relevant is that I've yet to meet a house that can replace a worker. So the whole story that the rising capital income share is going to lead to robots that replace workers is just not consistent with the trends we see in the data. I'm going to skip that. I'm going to go to the last thing, because what we want to do also in the second half after we question each other is we want to talk about policies. And I want to talk about work that I've been doing lately that I think is very important. And it relates to all the way back in the early 90s, thinking about how do we measure inequality, what should we think about it. There are lots of different things that could be unequal, like access to each other's slides or or whether you were born here or there. I think income inequality, that focusing on income inequality has led to some bad policy ideas, in part because it fails to appreciate the sort of importance of the spread of capitalism in reducing poverty, but in part for reasons that are clear by this latest work that I've been doing. About 6 years ago, I met right after Davos, one of the Facebook founders, Sean Parker, And he had a question about inequality, and we started talking, and then eventually he funded, and I agreed to be the head of the Board of Academic Advisors, a group called EIG, the Economic Innovation Group, that works on the problem of measuring inequality in a way that could sort of make good policy as well. And the thing that we got obsessed with at our first conversation that we've made a lot of progress in measuring is geographic inequality. And so one of the things that I think is interesting about America and challenging is that, you know, right now when we talk about inequality, we sort of say, hey, we need to have a higher top marginal rate. But you know, that will address inequality some. But the inequality in America that's the most striking, if you look at the data to me, but it's not really been studied much, or as much as it should, is the inequalities, the geographic inequality, the inequality of place. That there are a lot of places that are stuck with high unemployment rates and have been for a long time. In fact, the EIG, we started a distressed communities index where we measure performance on 7 economic indicators. You could go to EIG, our website, and sort of see. And this is a map of sort of where the distress is. But a distressed community is a place where if you're a kid, you know, the odds of you moving up are really, really low. The schools are going to be terrible. The crime is going to be high. And here's an example of, and again, so this is not income inequality, but this is something that I think moves us closer to thinking correctly about the right policies we need to adopt. In the average zip code in the top quintile of prosperity, 6% of adults have no high school degree. In the average bottom quintile zip code, 23% have no high school degree. 6% of adults live in poverty. In the rich places, the poor places, it's 27%. 35% of adults are out of work. In the bottom quintile of distress, by our measure of distress, it's 55%. 5% of homes stand vacant. 14% of homes stand vacant in the distressed communities. And most interesting, and this is the thing that's most troubling in the data, is that these areas of distress stay distressed. That nothing has helped. People aren't talking about them. If you wonder why is it everybody all of a sudden is responding so positively around America to the messages of Bernie Sanders or Donald Trump, it's because they're talking about to people who feel like our debate about income inequality and the top marginal rate hasn't done a damn thing to help Camden. And if you look at from 2010 to 2013, that's when the recovery began. Nationwide, employment went up 17.4%. In the distressed communities, it's gone down 7% since the recovery began. And the number of establishments in distressed communities has dropped 8.3% at the same time. And so my view is that if we think about inequality, we need to have a sort of more subtle debate than you often see, certainly in public, especially, I guess, in recent Republican debates. And that it needs to include thinking about, really, I think the biggest inequality problem right now is spatial inequality. The fact that there are all these places that are broken and that are sort of academic arguments about Gini coefficients and marginal tax rates haven't done a darn thing to help the really distressed places. I've got a closing thing from Schumpeter, but I'll go back to that at the end, because I think that Schumpeter anticipated this. Oh, that was odd. And so anyway, so thanks so much. So I think that summarizes the way I think about inequality and the work that I've been doing. And now we're going to move up here and begin to ask each other questions. Is that correct? That's okay. Thank you.
Is that yours or is that mine?
Did you take one?
That's mine.
Okay.
Okay. Okay. So do you want me to talk about what you said, or do you want to?
Yeah. Whatever order you want.
Okay. All right.
I just finished talking, so why don't you talk?
Okay. So I don't want to turn this into a love fest, but I will agree. I just want to agree with Kevin was kind enough to agree with all my slides. I want to be clear on that, all my slides. So I do want to agree with some of the things he said. First, with respect to economic growth, so former Act 21 alums will remember this statement I'm about to make. The current Act 21 alums, we haven't gotten to it yet because we haven't gotten to growth theory. But I posed the following question. I said, is our standard of living greater than Neanderthal man because we understand how to eliminate microeconomic inefficiencies? In other words, Neanderthal man couldn't equate marginal utility to marginal cost, but we can.
Or is it because we know how to run a macroeconomy and so we can get our economy to closer to full employment, whereas the Neanderthal man didn't understand about aggregate demand and how to do that?
So our magic is cash for clunkers. That's
right. Or yeah. Or is it economic growth? And the answer is it's economic growth. That economic growth is the thing that's singly most responsible for raising standard of living. On the other hand, nobody has a little magic wand that will raise a country's economic growth. There isn't a agreed upon methodology to achieve that. But still, there's no question that economic growth is essential. That's A. B, something I also say sometimes is that there's only two lessons in economics. Lesson one is that markets are wonderful. Lesson two is that markets are not so wonderful. So we're up to lesson two. We're already granting lesson one because we're economists. And so it's definitely the case that markets have achieved amazing things throughout the world. Doesn't mean they can't be improved upon. The consumption data that Kevin had, I have some technical responses to that, which I'll get to if we have time. I'm not a fan of the, right. So there's a joke that goes like this. What's the difference between theory and practice? In theory, they're the same, but in practice, they're different. And so the thing is, his theory about consumption, I don't have a problem with. But in practice, the data he's using is not very good. And so I have some slides on that because I did get his slides in advance. But that's not the only kind of inequality. I just want to be clear on this. Why is my head so small in this poster?
That is the only picture of me on the internet where I'm frowning that like that too. Okay.
And the last thing I'll say is location inequality, big issue, but places are made of people. So if you can change the inequality that exists among people, it'll disproportionately help those regions that have disproportionate amounts of poorer people or low-income people. So it's not like they're independent strategies. However, it is certainly possible, in fact, I'm sure for sure true, that you might want to have locational strategies that particularly target particularly distressed areas. That has not been actually that successful in the United States. We've been trying to fix Appalachia for like 50 years. But I'll just simply say I'm totally in favor of all that. But that requires more government, not less government. And that's all I'm saying.
The first thing is that I said that I stipulate that your slides are correct in the sense that the data in the slides say what the slides say, but not every slide was correct in the sense that the productivity and wages slide, it's just a technical point for the economists in the audience, but Robert Lawrence has shown...
Yeah, I have that.
Yeah, but that wasn't Lawrence's.
No, I can talk about that. That's definitely... So I call that...
Can I finish the point because they
yes,
haven't read
go ahead.
So the point is just that if you go and you add some output, then the wage should be set equal to your value marginal product. So they sell the output at the margin, and then that should be what you get paid. But the price is the stuff that you make, not the stuff that you eat. And so the labor market equilibrium is that the stuff that you make, that productivity determines your wage. A lot of people have made charts that look like Marx, but again, it wasn't. I couldn't tell from the documentation if it was one of these, but I think it was because Lawrence's paper makes a sweeping statement that if you look at marginal product and wage in the U.S. And you look at use the price of the stuff that we make, then the markets still look like they're functioning the way markets do in our microclasses. And so that chart I thought was misleading. But you're saying that you've resolved the dispute between Lawrence and the literature, decided Lawrence is wrong, have yet to publish that paper, but will dispose of it nonetheless. Is that your position?
I have a slide. Would you like me to get it?
No.
Okay.
No, I believe your slide.
Okay,
just say what it says.
No, so Kevin's point is a good point. This is also inside baseball. So I showed two slides that relate to this issue. One is as what's called the race between productivity and total compensation. That slide is iffy for the reason Kevin said. But the second slide, which is the share of GDP in the non-farm business sector, that's labor versus capital, that is still perfectly fine.
That is true. But the income that's trending up is housing.
Yeah, I have a slide about that, too. I have this appendix with all the things I was going to argue with him about. But okay. So you're right about that. And he's right that, well, we can talk about Piketty, but I have a slide. Never mind. I agree with you on what you said about that.
He asked not to defend Piketty tonight.
Yeah, I said,
and I said fine.
Kevin, who's been spending the last 4 years attacking Piketty, wanted me to defend him.
That's not
him.
True. I've been clarifying
too
his
smart
errors.
To do that.
And helping him improve.
Okay, so but the last thing is about this total compensation productivity versus what you sell, the price of what you sell versus the price of what you buy. So that's a real issue, and that is a part of the story, definitely. But there still is that part that's due to an increase in capital share. And I have a slide for that.
Okay, so now I want to talk about policy, and I want to think about, so let's assume that the distressed community thing is a real thing.
Yeah, it
is a real thing. We all know it is. I encourage you to go download our study and look at the, we have granular detail. We've estimated this for zip code level data, and so you can look at your own town and think about what you learned. And again, the most distressed community is Camden, New Jersey, in the country. But I also asserted that I think that the income inequality debate, the way it's happened politically, has been harmful for thinking about policy that will help. And you seem to disagree in the sense that, well, you know, if we get some growth, then we're going to help Camden too. I think that my slide kind of shows that that's not true in the sense that at least since this recovery happened, these places are actually falling deeper and deeper down into despair. And so I would assert that if we think about how we could help Camden, first, I know that everybody in this audience wants to. And in fact, one thing that I often say when I'm talking about the distressed community things is how many of you want to try to make a difference? And everybody says, I do. And then I ask, which I could say, how many people here think you can make a difference? Is there something that you can do right now to help? Well, maybe you could help individuals, but the fundamental problem right now, you don't have a way to do it. And so this is the thing that we've been working on at EIG. And the basic idea is that, first of all, a lot of the things, I don't accept that a lot of the things that currently dominate the inequality debate at the national level are going to be helpful for this. So, can we help Camden, New Jersey by lifting the minimum wage in Camden, New Jersey to $15 an hour? I don't think any of us think you can. Do you think you can?
Probably not. Not by itself, no.
Yeah. Okay. Can we help Camden, New Jersey by taxing the rich people in Camden, New Jersey more?
Yeah, it's probably not enough.
It's not enough. So why is it that these places are distressed? It's basically because they don't have enough capital. That they're you know, as you know, defined in our micro models. So the proposal that we've put out that comes back to that first conversation with Sean a long time ago is this, that we think that the reason why the people who have tried to, most people don't talk about it. They just, I think in part because they think that they've given up. It can't be solved. But the few times people have tried things like enterprise zones or something, but they haven't recognized that there's a fundamental design problem that the game theorists of the audience would recognize, that there are two possible equilibria in distressed communities. One is that nobody goes, no capitalists go and invest and try to give people the capital that they need to prosper, and the other is that everybody races to get there. And the design problem for policy is to try to come up with some kind of mechanism so that everybody's in a race to get there. You have to change the Nash equilibrium. And the policy that we've come up with that I think might be legislated this year is designed to do that, and it's this. And if it's radically different from the kind of stuff that I think you would talk about in a presidential debate if you're talking about income inequality and then what. If we create a new kind of, call it investment fund, private equity fund, mutual fund, that invests only in our people tell us we're supposed to call them domestic emerging markets. Okay, so that you, if you go to Vanguard.
Good luck with that.
No, let me finish. If you go to Vanguard and you could move your money, you've got your TIA CREF has been in the stock market your whole life, probably, or a lot. If you could move it into a fund that can only invest in distressed communities, then all you people who want to make a difference finally have a way to do it. And our simulation suggests that hundreds of billions of capital could move if we just made it so that people could roll unrealized capital gains into distressed community funds. And then these places could only make money if they invested places that are distressed and make a profit. And then if they do that, then there's going to be a race to make a profit. They could actually, the first people could make huge profits, because right now real estate costs almost nothing in these places. And then that would drive a positive cycle where people recognize that if you want to improve welfare, you need to give people more capital. So I assert that, that idea, maybe it works, maybe it doesn't work. I think it might be legislated this year, so there'll be arguments about it in the House of the Senate. But the point is just that I think that that conversation about how to do that is fundamentally different from the conversation you usually see about inequality. And that's the sense in which maybe I'm saying something that's different. So I think that inequality arguments at college campuses and in the media and in politics have been kind of destructive, because they've been kind of discouraging capital from playing along and helping to solve the problem.
Right. So the reason first of all, I think it's worth a shot. You know, absolutely. Kevin's right. He talked about equilibriums. And so what these communities are stuck in is a really low-level equilibrium. I would disagree that it's only low-level because it doesn't have enough capital. It's also low level, as you saw, because people have very low education levels, very low skill levels, low human capital. So it's a combination of very little physical capital, very little human capital. And so I don't know that just giving the financial sector an incentive to try to invest there and not raising up the human capital, I don't know how well that would work. I'm perfectly happy to try that. I also don't think relabeling, you know, the most distressed communities in the United States as emerging communities is going to convince anybody. But I do think, but it is a huge problem, and I'm happy, go with God, you know. Anything anybody wants to do, I'm totally happy with that. Do we want to go to the...
So we now have half an hour for questions and answers from the audience.
Oh yeah, why don't we do some questions?
Sure. So before we proceed to the next section, which is solutions, we thought it would be nice to intersperse a few questions that people have written down and passed forward. So the first question that we ask of you is, how can you have a debate about economic inequality in the U.S. and not even mention race?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you should. That the question is exactly right. And I'll tell a story about this that's a really important one, and the distressed communities are certainly not heavily Caucasian,
right.
And I think it's an important thing to talk about. We absolutely could have mentioned that by any metric we're failing on that. The thing that is interesting for me about this topic in policy is just like my own personal experience that I gave a testimony at the House Financial Services Committee about how the economy is doing and the recovery a few years ago, and I made a bunch of slides on how the recovery is going by race, and if you looked at it, then it was a great recession that started to end around 2010 for white people, but it's a great depression for black people, and it looks just like the Great Depression. The data it's astonishingly similar and really disturbing. So I had these charts that said that. And then something funny happened in the hearing that shows sort of how broken politics are. That Maxine Waters, the Democratic congressman from, I guess, New York State, right? Is that right?
No, California.
California. But Maxine Waters declared me at House Financial Services Committee a national hero for bringing race into the debate about this. At which point, many of the Republicans on the committee started to treat me as a hostile witness, even though they invited me to the hearing. It was a very, very strange day. But afterwards, Barney Frank came up to me, and I said, Barney, geez, you know, the Republican staffer that invited me, that I think he's probably feeling like the adversarial nature that, or the love you showed me, was something that they didn't anticipate, and he's probably going to be worried that he's going to be fired because, one side of that was that when you guys started loving me, that the Republicans started hating me, and maybe that's a sign of how broken politics is. But Barney said, "Don't worry, his job is safe. I've got a meeting with Republicans tomorrow, and the first thing I will do is denounce you." And he did. He actually did.
Okay, so my job is safe too. So I'm going to say something that may be a little unpopular with respect to this question. First of all, race matters a lot. There's no question about it. But, and I've been here a long time, I would say a thing that's bothered me a bit in the time I've been in Swarthmore is the increased emphasis on ethnicity versus social class. And I feel that that's not to say Black lives don't matter. That's not to say that race doesn't matter. It totally does. But I do think we here emphasize race and diversity issues more than social class, the exclusion of social class, in a way that really is inaccurate. So I'll just give you one. I don't have the exact number. But if you look at white females with less than a high school degree, their mortality rate has skyrocketed. And in all of the relatively advanced world, the only analog to the increase in their death rate is what happened in the Soviet Union and Russia after the Soviet Union collapsed. It is in the entire world the single biggest increase in mortality for white women who have less than a high school degree. So I just think that there's problems out there that a lot of the problems out there cannot be reduced to race. That's not to say that race isn't a big part of the problem.
The thing that makes race important in this, that I think I might be disagreeing, is that let's imagine that you're a person who is lucky enough to be born with all the talent in the world. So we'll do a counterfactual. And that you're thinking about you're thinking about investing in the future in your own human capital, and trying to get ahead. Imagine if you're a person who, knows that 20% of the people out there are going to not give you a shot no matter what you do. Maybe it's gone down a lot. I don't know what the percentage of racist people is. Maybe someone has an estimate. But I think the fact that's got to be discouraging. It's got to I think that's a unique characteristic of race in the U.S., especially with our history, that the policy certainly hasn't addressed. Is there other questions?
Okay, I think this is more of a clarification question, but it might be helpful to review and hear your reply to this. From my understanding, economic growth is the key to reducing poverty globally. However, I am quite skeptical that the spread of capitalism that we, presumably the U.S., can humbly claim credit for is a key component to raising the level of economic growth globally. So I'm wondering if Mr. Hassett can elaborate on the point he made.
We don't have a lot. Actually, so I could turn it into a question for Mr. Cooperberg, which is, have you read Xavier Sala y Martin's sort of links between capitalism and inequality? So I find them convincing, I said, but do you find them not convincing?
I haven't read them.
Okay. But again, you could think about the China chart, right? So there are a lot of, so India was centrally planned, right? So there are a lot of places where they're centrally planned and then not. And then you start to see those income distributions look the way that they looked in that China chart. So I showed the China chart for a reason. But the person who asked the question should just Google Xavier Sala y Martin, and he's got these papers that go on for hundreds of pages that go case by case, talk about what happened in this country, what year the change was, and then you can see that the distributions tend to move around that period where they stopped having a really big government. But the point is, though, that those big governments maybe weren't as clever as the big government you argue for in your TEDx talk, right? So why were those big governments, why did they fail compared to the reforms that they made, and why would your big government not?
Okay, well first, so remember I said there's two lessons in economics. Markets are wonderful. That was the first lesson.
You're right.
So I disagree with the question writer that capitalism/markets hasn't been responsible for the increase in equality and growth around the world. I think it has played a very significant role. The second thing is the markets I'm talking about are, once again, it's with respect to the second question, markets are not so wonderful. So it's really after you've run have a market economy, what problems remain, right? And so those economies that didn't work, they didn't have big governments and free markets, they just had big governments and big government's running everything. Yeah, that's not a good system.
Yeah. So there's even before I go to the next question, if there are others, there's even a literature on this that I commend to you. If it's not, it's probably on your reading list. But do you ask people to read Becker and Mulligan's stuff on optimal taxation? So the basic idea is that if you want to have a big government, then you need a really efficient tax system, because the bigger the tax gets, the more the distortion that the tax creates. And so the most efficient type of tax is a consumption tax. There's a big academic literature on this. And a value-added tax is a consumption tax. And so it's no accident that European nations that have really large governments compared to our own, that they have value-added taxes to finance them. So I guess part of your design for the bigger U.S. government would be a value-added tax, too?
I'd go for more of a straight consumption tax item. But that's pie in the sky. It's never going to happen. So progressive consumption tax.
Yeah, okay, the X
we've
tax.
We've been getting a lot of really good questions. We can't get to all of them, and unfortunately, and some of them, the handwriting is too unique to read. So we'll finish with this one and then move on to the solutions and concluding arguments. This one is personally addressed. Kevin, suppose I agree with all of your Piketty critiques. Tell me why I shouldn't be worried about a long-term low-growth regime for the entire world, leading to your lovely global income distribution curve skewing further to the right without actually shifting to the right. Thanks. Heart.
Oh, skew rather than shift. Yeah. That could happen, I suppose. So Piketty's view is that we should look at the country level, because that's where politics happens. And that when wealth becomes unequal, then that's going to lead to political inequality, and then the rich are going to abuse everybody else. I submit that hasn't happened yet, and that I don't know whether it's going to happen. Larry Lessig, who the Harvard law professor who ran for president, he and I were at a conference together, talked a lot about this a couple weeks ago. Lessig's view is that money in politics is really out of hand, and that it's polluting democracy, but not maybe destroying it yet. And he gives an example that really was stimulating for me to think about the role of money in politics. And it gets back to the thing that Piketty said that I thought was his best point, that in Texas, it turns out that they once had a law that said that only whites can vote in primaries, but then everybody of all colors gets to vote in the general election. Now, I would submit that there's nobody in this room that thinks that that's democracy. That's not democracy, right? So Lessig said, well, now we're in a world where instead of the whites picking the candidates, the rich people and the PACs, they pick the candidates, and then you get to vote. And so how is that democracy? And I think that that's a fair point.
We'll find out tonight, right?
Yeah. Perhaps, but I think that so I'm an economist, and there are political scientists I know in the room, but that's the sort of next thing that we have to study, because it could happen, but I don't think that it's in the data yet, the bad things that we can imagine.
Okay, so we'll go back to part two.
Okay,
I need you with your magic wand to
my magic mouse.
Thank you.
There you go.
Okay, so now we're up to what possible solutions are there. And so first, this is a kind of a schematic of how economists think about things. So we start with endowments. People, as it were, come to the market with labor and capital. Then they go to the market, and then out pops labor and capital income. Then they could save some, or they could go to school. There's actually some leisure here in the endowment, which you could go to school and use up. So that's how the system works. So just to fixate it, think about Jack and the Beanstalk. He comes to the market with his cow. He gets some peas, trades for them, and then he plants them. That's a form of investment in savings. And then the rest is history. So So the thing about this chart is that it says there's three ways you can intervene. You can intervene at the endowment level, you can intervene in the market itself, you can intervene after the labor and capital income has been determined. And my view is we should intervene in all three places, in part because I want to minimize the intervention in any one place. So how do you do that? So first you got to think about, well, why is there so much inequality in the U.S.? And once again, I'm staying with the U.S. So 1980, big year, big bad year. And so the ratio of the income, the wage of a college degree versus a high school degree was as low as it ever got in 1980, and it's been mushrooming up since then. So one way to interfere or influence the endowment side is to foster education. And that you need to do a lot of it, but if you did a lot of it, you would create more college graduates. That would depress the wage of college graduates a bit. You would create less just high school graduates, and that would raise the wage of just high school graduates a bit. You have to do that at a pretty big level to have effects throughout the economy, but that's how you would influence the endowment side vis-a-vis education. So this is Alan Krueger, who was the Council of Economic Advisors, the head of the Council of Economic Advisors for Obama for a while, gave this talk, which I've taken some of his other slides, The Rise and Consequences of Inequality. So that was 2010-12, but he used the 1997 charts. This is a 1997 chart. Somebody should update that. So according to this chart, Donald Trump is about 20% right. So international trade, 10% of the inequality. Rising immigration, 10% of the inequality. International trade, I think that number has gotten a lot bigger. I'm positive of that. So that's a bigger culprit. Technological change, which was the economist's favorite, is probably less than this. But anyway, you can summarize all that here, this is just a very simple supply and demand model. It's EC1, where the demand for labor is simply a linear trend. And a linear trend is in essence summarizing all these effects. And the supply of labor is just what percentage of the labor force is high school graduate versus college graduate. And it's amazing, I think, I'll just use the word amazing, how closely the red and the blue lines line up. That with this tremendously simple supply and demand apparatus, you're able to predict so well the gap between college and high school wages. So one way is simply to create more college graduates. That would work on the endowment side. And the reason that previous graph works so well is that that education in the U.S. has sort of plateaued a bit. So it was rising, and then it's kind of plateaued since 1960. It's rising a bit, but much slower. And so we're just not generating enough educated people, and that's a big part of the inequality story. And that's true throughout the entire distribution. So if you look at high school dropouts, high school graduates, some college, post-college, the more educated a person is, the higher their wages are. That's across the entire education distribution. So the second thing is training programs for people after they've gotten out of school. So these are a summary of a ton of studies that are all the ones over on this side are random controlled experiments, so they're like drug trials. These guys are not. And they, while a lot of people think these work, let's call them manpower programs, don't work. They're just a waste of government money. This one is here. But most of them are not. And most of them do raise people's wages substantially. Not all, but most do. So there's a lot of, Camden could use a lot of this. Minimum wage. So that's now interfering with the market box itself by changing the wage. Okay. So this is a chart that a lot of people know about. Minimum wage in constant dollars. So it was the highest in about 1973, and it's here now. I have a different way to look at it, which is the ratio of the minimum wage with respect to labor productivity. Because the argument against raising the minimum wage is that workers will price themselves out of the market, or the government will price workers out of the market for them. But that's a fight between their wages and their productivity. And so whether you're going to get priced out of the market, and as what you can see is this was when things were really high back in 73. But now, if that's number one, the ratio of the real wage to productivity is like 0.35 of what it was in 1973. So there's plenty of room to raise the minimum wage before you come to the point where workers are being paid more than their productivity. And labor unions, so you can see labor unions are down. That's, I view, not good. And finally, so the United States, this is actually a surprising graph. Why is it surprising? It's because we think the United States is, it's land of opportunity, but the flip side of the land of opportunity is that there's a lot of market-generated inequality. Surprisingly, not so bad, actually. So if you look at the Gini coefficient before taxes and transfers, so this is the market-generated inequality. The United States is here. It's Denmark, where nobody wants to live, of course, is better. Canada, better. But, you know, there's a whole bunch of countries that you wouldn't realize. You'd think, no, they must have more equal pre-tax and transfer income in the United States, and they don't. So, like Norway. But after tax and transfer, after their governments have gone in to, this is now manipulating that last box. Once the incomes are determined, to what degree are you transferring around, the United States is the worst. The United States goes from being better than the middle, I mean, it's pretty close here, but better than the middle in terms of market-generated inequality to being the most unequal because we do the least with transfers and taxes. So I would say there's room there too. And so this is the same thing. I want to give Kevin another chance. So this just shows, this is with respect to federal taxes and transfers. So this is the reduction in the Gini coefficient, 8% due to taxes, because we do have a progressive tax system to some degree. This is the reduction due to transfers, and the little blue line is the reduction due to transfers and taxes, the amount of reduction. So this is, once again, in that very last box, you have endowments, market, incomes that we do in the United States, tax and transfer that market income, you know, and make things more equal. It's just that we don't do it as much as other countries. And finally, and poverty. So you think poverty, you know, it's the same. Poverty will always be with us. The government hasn't done nothing wrong. So by a better measure of poverty than the official measure is pretty lousy, I think Kevin will agree with that. So there's this other measure, supplemental poverty measure. And poverty, that's the blue line. Poverty has gone down pretty substantially. And here is total safety net. Has reduced poverty from, if there were no government assistance, 27% down to 15% for everybody, and for children, from 27% down to 16%. And I think that's my last slide. So these programs do work. Yeah, okay.
I don't need my slides.
Oh, okay.
Should I
clear? No, that's fine. That's a beautiful slide.
Wait.
It leaves everyone to wonder.
Let me show you this. Okay. Since we're here.
Wait, your time is up.
There you go.
Your time is up. Yeah, we can leave that one up too. We can let people think about that. So I think that let's think about the problem from the point of view of somebody in the audience. That you want your consumption to be higher 5 years from now. So how do you do that? Or 10 years from now? How do you do that? Well, you can invest in human capital. A lot of people are doing that right here. And increase your wage because people want to pay you more because you've acquired this glorious Swarthmore education. And it's a good strategy. It's proven over and over to work. Especially, I could add, to pat the economics team on the back again, for economists, that if you go to Greg Mankiw's website, you'll see that Swarthmore produces the most economists per capita of any school in the country by a lot. And it's because, you know, people like Mark fire people up to go off and get a PhD and learn how to do it right for a change. but the way, so you can invest in human capital. If you have more human capital, your wage will go up. But other than that, then the other way it can happen is that you have more physical capital to work with yourself. And so, or Think about it this way. If you want to go out to restaurants more 5 years from now, then back actually when I was a kid, it used to be that they had interest rates that were positive. Do you remember that?
Yeah,
yes. No, thank you. Yeah, so you could put money in the bank and then you would get like some money from that. It was great. It doesn't happen anymore. But you would put money in the bank and then you could take the interest on the money and you could go to the restaurant with that. And so that you could have higher consumption in the future because you had some money in the bank, which you could think of as the capital. And so if you want your consumption to be higher down the road, the two things you could do are human capital and physical capital, or capital. If you don't do that, then you know maybe you could borrow on your credit card and finance some consumption, but then when you try to pay it back, you're not going to have the income to sustain that higher level of consumption, and your consumption will go back down. And so you'll decide not to do it. I submit that the same is true for a country. That if we want our country to have more stuff 5-10 years from now, enough stuff so that we can change people's lives and continue to reduce poverty, then we have to do better at developing human capital and do better at developing physical capital. In human capital, there's a lot of work on education. It's very bipartisan work. Guys, scholars at AEI worked with Cory Booker on the Newark schools for years, and I think they've made a lot of progress there. There have been a lot of charter schools in DC that have radically changed lives. I think that the education part of the puzzle, we might have different prescriptions about how to do it, but we agree. I think Mark might be more sensitive to, like he wanted people more college degrees, but I think that really the failure of our education system is biggest the earlier you go, and that we need to think heavily about hard about how we're gonna do that. But the physical capital side gets back to the inequality debate, that there's way too little physical capital in the US right now. And there are a lot of reasons. But I think the biggest reason is something that's sort of a captive of the political process. And that is that we have this bizarre, stupid corporate tax system that encourages multinationals to put, make their new investments, move their money abroad. I can remember that it used to be that when I was in high school, we had to walk through the woods to get to the donut shop. We had an open campus. You could go to the donut shop. And I can remember when I would walk through the woods to get to the donut shop, there were always these kids that I didn't see in my AP classes who were like standing in a circle with this cloud of smoke around them. And I'm not sure exactly what they were doing, but I did recognize that there was some kind of correlation with what they were doing in the demand for donuts. but I submit that if we were to take one of those guys and let him design a tax code that was responsive to the idea that if we want wages to go up, that human capital, we need more capital, that they would have come up with something better than what we got. Because here's what we got. Right now, if you're a multinational and you locate profits in Ireland, you pay almost no tax. If you locate the profits in the US, you pay the highest tax in the developed world, the third highest in the world. Do you know the two countries that have higher corporate taxes than us?
You mean the legal,
statutory? No,
tax.
I'm getting to this point. The statutory corporate rate is higher in two countries, Guyana and the Congo. But other than that,
so now
the
let's get to the effective corporate rate.
No, but this is so. Let me teach you, my friend, about the Laffer curve. So how do they do this? Well, the way you do it, it's very easy. If you're a multinational, if you locate your intellectual property in a tax haven, then every sale you make anywhere on earth, you can have that that subsidiary or the parent in the US pay royalties to the sub in the tax haven so that the profits end up there. And so what multinationals want to do then is expand their operations in tax havens and then locate the intellectual property in the tax havens. And then because that they get to do that, then they can mail all their profits to the tax haven. The U.S. doesn't get any tax from that until they mail the money home, which, guess what, they never do. So it just piles up. And you hear people saying we need a tax holiday so they bring the money home. It's trillions of dollars offshore and so on. But this is the game that everybody plays. But notice what the person who loses is the worker in the U.S. Because in order to play this game to get the profits over there, you need to make it in Ireland. You could sell it wherever you want, and then the profits are in Ireland, you don't pay tax. And so the corporate tax system in the US raises very little revenue. This is what you're saying about the effective rate. But the reason it raises little revenue is that the multinationals are really good at avoiding it by basically giving the jobs to other countries. How did we get here? I think we got here because the natural constituency On the Democratic side, I think, again, has been too much focused on traditional, like, narrow debates about income inequality. And the idea that you would cut the corporate tax in the U.S. is anathema to the left. I've had very senior people in the White House tell me that they sort of get this, but they can't bring it up with their own caucus because there are too many people that hate corporations and would never want to, or that they don't actually hate them, but they don't want to say they're cutting the taxes because it makes them look bad. But on the right, if you think about the corporate community. Let's just say that the right is the community of corporations, big money corporations. They don't want to have a tax reform because right now, if someone who's a fiduciary for a corporation, you've got the best of all worlds. You've got the highest tax on earth, so nobody tries to argue that it should go up, and you don't pay it. What's better than that? If you have a tax reform, you know, you're going to be worse off. So you argue don't do it. And so we're stuck with this system right now where there's no political momentum for a corporate tax reform, which would give us one of the two things, higher education or higher capital. That would drive wages up. We've got a tax code that encourages people not to do that, and we can't fix it because we're sort of stuck. And we're stuck because maybe big business is always going to oppose anything that you might do to make it so that the system's different. But the people on the left need to recognize, and this is work I didn't cite, but there's a big literature, I had an early paper of this, that shows that corporate taxes are a really important factor in determining blue-collar wages across countries. That when corporations move their activity to Ireland, that it benefits workers in Ireland. And so when we talk about inequality, let me leave you with the final thought. That I think that the inequality debate in the U.S. politically has been kind of destructive. It's focused on the wrong things. I think that the things that Mark would propose just now, I think he already conceded that he wouldn't necessarily want to do in Camden, but he also concedes that Camden's a big part of the problem. Like, so you didn't want to increase the minimum wage in Camden, right?
Well, I'm just saying that wouldn't solve the problem totally because the businesses there can't pay the minimum wage, right? I mean,
right.
The businesses there are hanging on by their thumb.
But that's where the unemployed people are, is where the businesses are hanging on by their thumbs.
Right,
where the businesses
right now,
are prospering, unemployment rates are low. And so I think that where I disagree is that I think that we need to get a left in America that understands that capital can be their friend. And then we need to think about rules that we can adopt. So here's a final one, and then I won't do a summary, unless yours is so glorious that. So suppose that we did something so that capital was really attracted to the U.S. Okay, so that I think that the economists in the room would stipulate that then the marginal product of the workers in the U.S. would go up. Suppose the same time that we did that, we did something like the try to switch the Nash equilibrium to everybody's capital wants to go to the distressed communities. And so we did it kind of, capital, we're going to track capital, we're going to do it with steroids. So then the concern that you have is that, well, that marginal product, that the higher marginal product is going to be kept by the company. It's not going to go to workers because you gave that chart. The marginal product of the wage is different. And so where I leave you is that I think the challenge for us is to think about what rules you could agree to so that when we do that, you're comfortable that American workers will benefit. And I think if we do that, then we'll see, probably a much more productive policy debate. So thank you very much. So he doesn't have any rules that would guarantee. Because I don't know.
I mean, you never know what charts to bring. So I have a whole chart on the corporate statutory rate and the effective rate. Just a tiny point. The corporations that pay the lowest effective rate are mining and extraction industries. They can't move to Ireland, right? They can't actually drill for oil in Ireland. So I think the low corporate effective tax rate is much more complicated than just people offshoring their profits.
Right. There are special, in mining, there are lots of special things,
deals, yes.
Special deals for exploring loose sands
the
versus.
The guys with the highest effective rate are computers, and you think they would be able to move pretty quickly.
But the thing is that the thing that's interesting about the transfer pricing tax literature is that anybody can play this game. So that even the mining companies can say that the trick that they use to get more gas out of that well is something developed by their team in Ireland. And then when they use that trick, they have to, you know, mail money to Ireland as a return on that intellectual property. And so that's why the corporate revenues of the U.S. are so low. So but with that, I don't think that we're ever going to, if we don't address that, then and we only do education, then we're going to leave the how do we get capital back here to help workers' products go up, that we're going to leave that unaddressed. So we close?
Sure.
Do you want to close, Paige?
So you have no concluding arguments to make, et cetera, et cetera?
I think that's correct.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
Good.
Well, marvelous. I guess I would first like to thank our speakers for their time and for their knowledge. We also thank you for letting us sensationalize your ideological differences for the sake of advertising this event. And thank you to our audience for filling this cinema. This is beyond our wildest dreams for such an event. And it's really encouraging for the future. So thank you to all. And then would you like to remain to chat with people?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, excellent. Well, with that being said, thank you so much, everybody.
Thank you, Paige. Thank you all for coming.